This is Democracy,
a podcast that explores the interracial, intergenerational, and intersectional
unheard voices living in the world's
most influential democracy.
Welcome to our new episode of This is Democracy. Our topic today is the recent government shutdown and the continuing debates over that and a possible future shutdown, as well as the border wall. And we have with us our return guest, one of the few people who's really been so good we wanted to bring him back, my colleague and friend and pioneer of radio, television, and film, Paul Steckler. Welcome, Paul.
Glad to be here. Good morning.
Good morning. Good to have you on this morning. Before we turn to Paul, while he sips his coffee and I sip my coffee, we have Zachary Suri's poem. Zachary.
My poem today is titled Golden Toilets Sink the Titanic. I woke up and a quarter of everything was closed, left in the December snow to rust. On TV, he bartered, insulted, and cussed. And people went to sleep peeing their pants for 35 days. And the headline every morning ran in plain block letters, Golden Toilets Sink the Titanic. And all the world went manic, all the shows were spreading panic, refreshing CNN every 5 seconds at school, soup kitchens filling, gloomy mists of bored federal workers spiking porn use in the greater DC metro. And yet every fresh tab reminded us, specific to Atlantic, that day, Golden Toilet sunk the Titanic. And small allowances of $5.7 billion were demanded, and Nancy to him handed some cubes of beef bouillon and a BLT sandwich. And SNL that weekend ran a reel from World War II, because everything else was too real the month Golden Toilet sunk the Titanic. And no one really remembers how it ended. A head of hollow caved, and no one was really surprised. 3 weeks, cold cheeks against the winter storms, gigantic. But still everyone wondered how Golden Toilets could sink the Titanic.
That is wonderful, Zachary. What is the message of your absurdist poem?
Well, just about how absurd the entire shutdown was and the way that the media was able to impart to all of us the absurdity in a way that it hasn't before. And it didn't really legitimize it in the way that others did. And the frustration that Trump had with that.
Sure, and the frustration we as citizens had, right? Yeah. Well, Paul, how do people in the media think about a crazy moment like this? How did they approach this?
I think they approach it as a great story. You know, I get the sense that the media loves this. It doesn't make me feel great.
Why do they love it?
Because it's controversy, it's conflict, gives them something to talk about. It has the same people every night on every cable station yakking about stuff and saying the same things. It's, it's kind of like the campaign. You know, why was Donald Trump on TV every night? You know, no matter what his, you know, rambling 2-hour speeches were like, because people were watching.
Right.
You know, and so anything he does, no matter how nutty, you know, draws an audience. You know, so while people suffer and the government gets shut down and the two sides plot to be able to win the news cycle, you know, the media just loves it. And it's kind of like it's not a very positive thing if you look at it overall in terms of the health of the country.
Right. And it becomes a kind of Nancy Pelosi versus Trump phenomenon.
Yeah. And it's, somebody winning and losing, we all lost, you know, so it's kind of like, you know, this is very temporal sort of stuff. You know, the Republicans had a shutdown in 2013. You know, that was roundly criticized and people thought it was terrible, and they went on to win the elections in 2014. So if anybody thinks this particularly has an impact they think it's going to have, well, maybe, maybe not. You know, and whoever wins the news cycle doesn't always win the next election. It's like I said, this is all depressing.
Yes, yes. Do you think that some of the stories that were done, especially on NPR and through the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, of the federal workers themselves, of their experiences, do you think there was some public enlightenment in understanding that?
I suppose. They were good stories. You know, they were stories that needed to be told. The sense that I get, though, is that the tribal divide that we have right now is, you know, really coloring the way almost everybody seems to think of this stuff. You know, if you hate Trump, you're listening. If you love Trump, you're not listening,
right,
and saying it doesn't make any difference. So, sure, the stories were great, you know, and I think they were needed to be said. What their larger impact was, you know, it's hard to say, but that's what the media ought to be doing, you know, doing, you know, things where, you know, what's the actual impact of these policies? And it's the same sort of thing of going down to the border and finding out that, you know, the mayor of McAllen says we don't need a wall.
Right.
There's no, you know, chaos is not happening. You know, there's not a crime wave down there. I've never felt scared when I was down in McAllen, you know, but I have a feeling that wall supporters don't listen. You know, one of the interesting things that I've been hearing post shutdown is that, you know, the greatest supporters of the wall live in Wyoming and Michigan.
Yes, right.
Okay.
Right. Far away.
You know, and none of the congressmen on the border actually support the wall.
Right.
So it's, you know, when is this an actual, you know, issue on specifics, and when is this an issue on ideology? And it seems like it's an issue on ideology.
Right, right. So we have a new feature for this podcast. We have a number of students who, in anticipation of our discussion, have recorded questions for Paul. The first one is from a student of ours named Justin Bindle. And if we could play his question.
Major media outlets such as CNN and Fox News displayed the government shutdown timer, which recorded the number of days, hours, minutes, and seconds that the shutdown was lasting. My question is, what effect does this have on each outlet's viewer base? Is it intended to strike fear in the public? Is it meant to represent how long Trump can remain firm to his border control policy? What are the implications of this timer, and what emotions from our society is it intended to arouse?
Paul?
None.
None.
No, it's just, it's a media thing. It's kind of like, you know, like... I don't think it has any impact at all. It's kind of like, you know, it's something clever that a producer puts on
right.
the side of the thing. If it's on Fox, it's how many days will the Democrats, you know, foist this on us? If it's on MSNBC, how many days can the president do this insane thing and otherwise does it have any impact? I doubt it.
Yeah. I think for me and some of the people I spoke with, but again, we're coming at this, of course, from one point of view, it did have this sense of like a doomsday clock. Did you feel that way, Zachary?
Yeah, well, I think also it was meant to just, I think it was interesting, yeah, how it was used in different outlets, because I think that some outlets it was like, oh, it's, I think like on CNN and more liberal news sites, it was like, look at how crazy it is, it's 35 days, and then on others, I imagine it wasn't as prominent.
Right.
So
right.
I don't really think it had that much of a right. strong.
Right. What should the media do, Paul? What would you want them to do to better educate the public about the border and about the shutdown?
You know, in terms of the border, I'd like to see more coverage. You know, but like I said, it's not so much that I have a problem with the media. The media is audience driven. You know, it's interesting. I was watching cable a lot, you know, during the shutdown, to try to glean, you know, whatever had happened that day. And what I began to notice, I think I was watching MSNBC a lot because I like Brian Williams.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's one of the few cable people that isn't yakking and telling me stuff that I already know.
I agree.
And I'm talking about both sides. You know, and he had the same people on every night saying the same things.
Right.
Literally the same experts.
Right.
I think they were on call. They were like living in the basement of MSNBC. You know, what should the media be doing? The media, it's not so much what the media should be doing. Is anybody listening anymore? I mean, I think we've talked about this before when I was on the show. You know, Bill Bishop wrote a book called The Big Sort back in 2004, which is probably one of the more seminal books
yes.
on politics. It's not specifically about politics, about the fracturing of America into niche groups in terms of religion, in terms of marketing, in terms of political beliefs. So that was 2004. Is anybody listening anymore, you know, across the divide? You know, and if nobody's listening, then it doesn't make much of a difference what the media is doing, you know, so that it's not so much, you know, do I love the media? Is it fake media? I mean, they're doing the job that they're doing. And, you know, more stuff on the border, especially as a Texan, you know, or at least a faux Texan, you know, would be great because,
yeah.
you know, I've done lots of filming on the border. And I've never felt, you know, like
right.
it was really dangerous down there.
You didn't find caravans of
no.
enemies coming
no,
at
no.
you.
No, no. And I mean, there's places like over by Big Bend. Where exactly would you put this
right.
wall?
Right.
You know, this is all, you know, like to a large extent, you know, silliness, you
right.
know. I mean, it's not so silly because of the implications on our politics. I think the larger problem is, are we ever going to get past this? Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like you take a look at the shutdown and you take a look at our budget process, if there is a process, And just looking at where this is going and the inability of Congress to do anything, you know, besides score political points, where is this going? You know, or is this just, you know, rushing us into a, you know, into a world where China, you know, employs us to be able to do work for them? You know, it's kind of like, I think other countries, you know, that have more of a centralized control, you know, or you could call it, you know, more of a dictatorial control or whatever, look at this and they go, huh?
Right.
You know, it's kind of like as the, you know, the West falls apart in terms of politics, you know, call it Brexit, call it yellow jackets over in France or whatever. And this is like, this is really disturbing in terms of what the future is like.
No, it's a good point. I was talking to a group of visiting Chinese officials yesterday, and they were making this particular point. On the topic of fake news, which is, of course, related to this, much of what we hear about from the border in some news outlets is,
right,
is of course, fake news. We have another question. This is from Ali Reznicek, I believe. I hope I pronounced her name correctly. Ali, I apologize if I didn't pronounce your name correctly. Let's hear Ali's question.
I've recently seen a lot of hateful news on social media from both the left wing and the right wing concerning the need of a government shutdown over President Trump's border wall. Many of the articles I find are full of fake news that are being used by both sides of the argument. So here's my question to you. Does the First Amendment's freedom of speech justify and protect the fake news seen on social media?
You know, as somebody who doesn't do social media very much because of this, you know, of course the First Amendment protects this. You know, I don't want to do a both sides, you know, sort of thing. Okay, Fox News is pathetic.
Right.
Okay, I mean, I can give you an example of this. Back in 2008, I did a program for Frontline about the Obama-McCain race. It's really good, you know, really good program. The Choice spent a lot of time trying to—
I went back and watched it after you mentioned it last time. It was excellent.
Yeah, and I think I mentioned last time Fox News did their election special— right. And a half of it was about two guys that went to college at the same time as Obama who were from Indonesia who might have been terrorists. And I'm watching this and I'm going, what? You know, this is like crazy.
Right.
You know, now they're you know, so when we talk about fake news, Fox News is beyond Mars on this. Okay, that said, you know, they're fulfilling their demographic. That's what they want to hear, whatever that is.
Right.
Okay. And the Republicans have been much worse than the Democrats in terms of this stuff. But the Democrats are following suit. You know, it's kind of like, I can't get worked up on this fake news stuff. Okay. Right. I think it's fed by people's ideological tribal instincts or whatever. The bigger problem is what's going on in society. And quite frankly, we are not solving any of our problems. Right. You know, this is like, you want to solve the border? Okay, compromise.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's plenty of agreement in terms of needs for security, you know, needs for more judges down there, right, needs for more facilities so, you know, the kids are not put in cages. Okay, you know, and also, you know, needs for border patrols. Okay, this is all agreed by people. Okay, and nobody can sit down and think about this because, like, it's who's going to win the news cycle? Who's going to win the next election?
Right. It does seem to me, Paul, that as historians, right, both you and I recognize, I think, that we've gone through these kinds of rough media moments throughout our history, the late 19th, early 20th century. If you think of what urban media looked like with rival newspapers run by parties.
Mm-hmm.
And it does seem to me that the solution is not, of course, restricting the media, just the opposite. But the solution is when members of the public, particularly a new generation, mm-hmm. look for an alternative source that actually provides good problem-solving news.
Right.
Do you see that happening?
Can I continue my doom and gloom?
You
know, as newspapers begin to go out of business, you know, as people begin to cut down the people that are actually covering policy, you know, is this getting better? Or is this getting a lot worse? I mean, I would fear that in the future, unless all you're doing is reading the New York Times and the Washington Post mm-hmm. and listening to NPR, I guess, you know, who exactly is doing in-depth news? I mean, we live in Austin, Texas. You know, look at the coverage of the legislature, you know, compared to what it was 20 years ago mm-hmm. in terms of the bureaus. You know, is the only solution the Texas Tribune? you know, that does a pretty good job. Okay, but is that the solution to this? Having
that's what I was thinking about, right? I mean, so the Texas Tribune, which is a nonprofit,
yeah,
that provides, I think even those who have a different set of politics would say, you know, pretty in-depth, fair coverage of what's going on. And then you think of what NPR does, and
sure,
the way NPR subscriber base has increased quite a lot, actually, in the last mm-hmm. few years. Those seem to be good signs to me.
What if you live in Kansas? Right. I mean, what if you live in Wyoming? I mean, we're not liable to have Texas Tribunes in those places. You know, we have this is Austin, Texas. You know, we had people with a lot of money, you know, who are willing to be able to back something like this up. You know, there's a difference between Austin and most parts of the country. Our public radio and public TV stations are supported to a much larger extent here, you know, than in other parts of the country. You know, so sure, we're living in a bubble over here, which is great. What do you do if you're in Lubbock?
Right.
You know, or if, you know, at least you're in Texas and you get some of this right. stuff. So I think this is, again, you know, I used to live in New Orleans where I started making films and where I did politics. You know, the Times-Picayune now is down to 3 days.
Yeah.
You know, and it's fairly pathetic. You know, and a lot of the people that work there ended up working in that paper that comes out of Baton Rouge that tries to pick up, you know, the slack. But I mean, what it leads to is less coverage. How much coverage is there of what our legislature mm-hmm. does? Mm-hmm. You know, not that much right. considering how important it is, you know, and we have lots of coverage on fake news and on the border and all this stuff. But quite frankly, what's going to affect your life in a much greater extent is, are we actually going to fund public education?
Right.
You know, you want to lower property taxes, you know, but not increase the money that goes into public right. education. Guess what's going to happen?
Right. Right.
So,
well, what about, though, what we did see in the early 20th century and again in the mid 20th century, public efforts to create public funding for mm-hmm. these organizations? I mean, NPR and PBS are not that old, in fact, right?
I mean,
and in the early 20th century, there was the effort through the city manager system, through urban mm-hmm. reform, to create, again, factual news sites for people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually not that expensive, right?
Sure.
If states wanted to fund this,
sure.
they could, couldn't they?
Yeah, but I guess, you know, again, this goes back to the whole, you know, fracturing of American society. You know, public television, you know, is a product of the Great Society.
Right. Lyndon Johnson.
Well, you know, a lot of the reforms you're talking about in the early 20th century are the product of the progressive movement. Okay, do you see anything in the United States right now that would indicate to you that there is any kind of unanimity possible to be able to do these kinds of initiatives, at least publicly? You know, it's... You know, I don't. And, you know, it's kind of, you know, I keep thinking, what exactly would it take for somebody to get elected who can actually be a unifier? Is unification even possible anymore?
Mm.
You know, maybe it would take some sort of catastrophe, you know, where all of a sudden people would stop thinking about, you know, why they hate each other and figure out that if they don't like each other and we don't do something mm-hmm. specifically, mm-hmm. you know, together. You know, then doom and gloom really is going to happen, a Great Depression or World right. War II, and you don't wish that on anything.
Right, of course.
So, sure, those things are great, Jeremy, but are they liable to happen, you know, from a public entity when your public entity doesn't have that kind of, you know, you take a look at our government right now. It's as long as you've got like one more vote than somebody else,
right.
you can
right.
force through things.
Right.
You know, like Obamacare came through without a single Republican vote.
Right.
You know, the tax cuts came through, I don't think with, you know, what, the two or three Democratic
right.
votes, you know, and what's going on with the courts right now, you know, is like antithetical to the way the court system has worked in the past. You're forcing all these people through on party line votes, on Supreme Court votes, you know, where there's almost no crossing. This is not healthy for democracy.
I guess what I'm trying to get at, Paul, is how do we get beyond this division at the surface when we also know that there is a lot of unity beyond that, right? Most Americans believe climate change is a problem now.
Right.
Not that representatives don't believe that. They believe that. The vast majority of Americans wanted the government open. In fact, the Senate voted 100-0 to open it
sure.
before Trump decided to change his mind based on what he saw on right-wing television and radio.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that there isn't a consensus out there, and I'm not sure that the consensus out there is any less strong than it was 40 years ago. It's a problem of people in the media, in your world, not getting that story out and not bringing people together around that.
Yeah, but again, I agree that most people believe in climate change. Most people believe we shouldn't have a shutdown. Okay, but when you actually took a look at what's important to people, you know, especially for, you know, Republican voters, they might have tended towards that, but they didn't want to vote that
right.
way. You know,
Why not?
Because I think the partisan tribalism is more important than the specific issue. you know, the truism, you know, when I was in graduate school learning about, political participation and political behavior was that if I like Jeremy, then I assume that Jeremy's positions are closer to mine. Okay, that's more important than my issue positions.
Right.
And I think that, you know, as we split and my partisan leanings are based a lot on the fact that I hate you, as, you know, then I'm against whatever you're for.
Right, right.
You know, so how do you actually get any kind of consensus on issues where people generally agree?
Yeah.
I don't know. I just don't know.
Right. It sounds like you need a figure that people like, even if that figure is not in their tribe.
Yeah, some sort of a transformational figure, you know, right. If I had to invent that in a laboratory right now, I'm just not quite sure who that would be, what that would be.
Mm-hmm. Zachary, what do you think about this?
I think there needs to be more young people in politics and in the media, and that's one of the important parts that is being left behind in politics today, that they're focusing on what's going on right now in Washington, and when people butt heads, it's big stories. But I think it's more important to focus on educating young people on how media covers things and on fake news, but also on how they can get engaged in politics mm-hmm. and in the media.
Mm-hmm. Paul, on that point, do you see a difference in how young people consume media versus how middle-aged and older voters consume media? Beyond, obviously, how young people use more social media, but do you see them as... Does the evidence so far show that the young consumers are as tribal as the older consumers?
Well, as a decidedly un-young person, I have no idea. I think that... obviously the numbers show that fewer people are watching, the old mainstream
right.
ways of being able to do the news, and they're using more social media. I was thinking about this in terms of unification. I'm not going to use Beto O'Rourke as sort of like the model for the future. Okay. But he was able to, increase youth turnouts.
Yes.
Okay. Now, at the same time, not doing much in terms of like Latino turnout and having a game plan for, traditional Democratic constituencies. Okay, why was he able to do that? It was partially social media
right.
and partially personal, personality driven. If you actually ask, people, what does, Beto O'Rourke stand for? Good luck. He stands
right.
for being, I really like him.
Right.
Now, is that the model for young people in the future? Somebody who seems positive, who looks good, and can feel your pain in a way that maybe is a little bit less fake than President Clinton,
right?
And, I don't know. But now that may be the wave of the future, which is not issue driven at all.
Right.
Okay, and then somehow they go, can't we reason this out?
Right.
I don't know. In terms of young voters, it was nice to be able to see young voters actually voting in numbers
right.
closer to their numbers in society in Texas in the last election. Will they make a big difference in politics in the future? I mean, people are tending to say that younger voters are more liberal, than voters in general, that they have much more liberal social views. So I guess if you're a Democrat, that makes you happy. I don't know what that means in terms of actual specifics, in terms of harder issues, because not everything mm-hmm. is a social issue.
But I wonder how different that is, and maybe this is a good historical and optimistic mm-hmm. question to close on. It does seem what you're describing
mm-hmm.
sounds a lot like people who were drawn to Theodore Roosevelt in the early 20th century, or Franklin Roosevelt. There are a large number of people,
right.
you know this literature well, who said, I like Franklin or I like Theodore. I don't
right.
always like their policies,
yeah.
but I like them. And then I think of someone who you've covered better than anyone else, Ann Richards.
Mm-hmm.
It strikes me a lot of people liked Ann Richards, didn't actually know what her policies were.
Right. right. I suppose. Ann got elected in part because Clady Williams blew the race. I mean, if,
right.
if Clady had actually left the state for the last month, he probably would have won. And then they liked him, they liked her a whole lot, and she lost to George W. Bush, who was also a very likable candidate.
Right, but she did serve a full term as governor of Texas.
She did. And it seems like sort of the antediluvian era
yes.
of politics. Now that
yes.
it gets further and further yes. away, Teddy Roosevelt was president during a Republican dominated period of time. Republicans had wanted no part of him, and they put him on the vice presidential thing, and then all of a sudden got their worst nightmare when
right.
McKinley got killed.
Right.
And Roosevelt came in because of the Great Depression. A lot of times people are brought in, in different reasons and they rise to the moment. So again, who knows? It's kind of like anything could happen. You know, like the South Pole might melt tomorrow and all of a sudden half the United States is underwater and we have to all, you know, get together over in Kansas, you know, under a unifying leader. I don't know.
Well, I think, Paul, in your inimical way, you've given us both
hope
a lot
for the future.
A lot to worry about, but also a sense that things are going to change. I do think what you've captured so well, and you always do, are the ways in which it's really not about the media. It's about all of us as consumers.
The media is a reflection of who we are, you know, is I think the other way around. So,
absolutely. Well, Paul, thank you for joining us. Thank you for joining us, all of you listeners, for this episode of This Is Democracy.
This podcast is produced by the Liberal Arts Development Studio and the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.
The music in this episode was written and recorded by Harrison Lemke, and you can find his music at harrisonlemke.com.
Subscribe and stay tuned for a new episode every Thursday featuring new perspectives on democracy.